Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Your Book listeners. I really hope you're enjoying these archive treats as much as I am, and that you're discovering some new books through some of our old friends. And on the theme of new books from old friends, I'd like to tell you about a brand new book from your old friend me. My new novel, Pity Party, is coming this summer. It's the story of Catherine, a woman who lives by the rules, ticks all the boxes, and prepares for the worst, even while she hopes for the best. Then the worst actually happens, and as she tries to navigate life as a young widow, it turns out she was not prepared at all. Pity Party is a romantic comedy about grief. It's a satire about trying to be a good person in the 21st century, and it's a love story with a twist. Its fans include Marion Keyes, Nina Stibbe, and Katherine Heine, and hopefully you. Pity Party is out on the 11th of July, and I'd love to invite friends of the Your Book podcast to pre-order from wherever you get your books. I know quite a few of you have pre-ordered already, and I am so, so grateful. It really is the best way to support an author, and it's an incredibly helpful way to show bookshops and publishers that you're excited about reading the book. You can pre-order from absolutely anywhere, including Amazon, Waterstones, and bookshop.org. If you pre-order directly from your local independent bookshop, I will arrange a signed, personalised, dedicated bookplate for you. And if you order directly from my local bookshop, the Margate Bookshop, we can send your personalised copy straight to you. They deliver across the UK. There's a link to order Pity Party in the show notes. If you go to my newsletter, creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com, you can have an exclusive look at the very first chapter. Lauren Bravo says, Pity Party is the funniest book you'll read this year. I hope it makes you laugh. Hello and welcome to Your Book. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your shelfie-snapping, spine-cracking book inspector, come to judge your reading habits, even though I once couldn't find a bookmark and ended up using another book. I am so excited to tell you that this week's guest is Sophie Kinsella. I've loved Sophie and her universes for more than half my life. I was given her novel, The Secret Dreamworld of a Shopaholic, for my 16th birthday, and I was absolutely overwhelmed by the giddy, shimmering energy of it. I didn't know you were allowed to write so many jokes or books about women who are the architects of their own triumphs and disasters. I've been an obsessed fangirl ever since, alongside millions and millions of readers. At the last count, she sold 40 million books. Her newest book, out now and published by Transworld, is I Owe You One, the story of Fixie, an adorable, sparky young woman whose emotional investment in the family business needs protecting from her actual family. It's a story about love and relationships, romantic ones, friendships, and the connection we have with our careers. I think it's one of Sophie's best ever books, and the bar is high. We met Sophie at her home in central London. As Sophie's most celebrated heroine, Becky Bloomwood, might put it, a hop, skip, and a contactless tap away from some really good shops. So what I love is I can see some really gorgeous children's books, and some I'm quite familiar with, and some are entirely new to me. The Dribblesome Teapots by Norman Hunter. This has got the loveliest cover. So this is a puffin?
I mean, basically, these are just genius stories for children. They are so funny. They are just silly, silly humour. They're the kind that I love. They're utterly benign. They're just kind of ridiculous and absurd. They're all about sort of kings deciding to hire somebody to slay a dragon, only the dragon decides to apply for the job. And it sort of twists on old-fashioned fairy tales, but just very silly, very, very witty. Lots of kings sort of running out of cash and resorting to funny means. And I don't think they're very well known. I think I read that when I was a child myself. I've read it to all my children. I've had to track it down sort of online, you know, because I lost my copy.
Oh, so this isn't what this is... A copy that you've
this
had
is
to...
because I've been through copies. I've sort of lost them, or you know, we've lent them, and it's one of those books that I just have to have in the house. Look, The Queen Who Economized. I mean, it's just brilliant, and they're sort of always deciding to. I mean, it really speaks to me. They're deciding to sort of give up the robes and you know sit on deck chairs instead of thrones.
I have to ask: is this part of Becky Bloomwood's origin story?
I'll tell you what. You know, when I knew I was going to be doing this, I started looking through all sorts of books that I probably hadn't thought about for years and years and years. And I could really see a theme. I could see where, especially in the children's books, I think, you know, for me, the books that I read as a child are just in my heart. And also, I probably read them about 30 or 40 times. I am a real rereader. And I certainly was as a child. I would just read the same old book again and again and again until it was kind of internalized. And I loved books that had a really great voice, you know, a funny voice, like E. Nesbitt, My Naughty Little Sister, and Ramona, who I just adore to this day.
Let's look at Ramona, because I do think that it's like when you're young, it's like revisiting a friend, isn't it? And going to play at their house, and it's familiar in the loveliest way. And I think I enjoy things more after the first read, when sort of I know all the peril has been resolved,
yes,
and you can just really enjoy the characters and the voice and the story.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a real believer in rereading. Ramona is just the most wonderful character, and I mean, sort of similar to Becky Bloomwood or some of my characters. She just has her own internal logic.
Yes.
And she sees the world as she sees it, and she cannot understand why people are at odds with her. And of course we can understand where she's coming from, and then we can see, you know, where all the grown-ups and other people are coming from. I mean, there's this brilliant bit where she goes to school for the first time, and the teacher says, sit here for the present. Well, that's it. And she thinks there's going to be a present. And honestly, my children laugh and laugh, but they're sort of on the edge of their seats thinking, oh no, when is this the hideous truth going to become apparent? This is just so tragic. She's clinging on to this idea she's going to get a present when there's no other evidence. She just heard this one phrase. And then, life is not fair for her. You know, people misunderstand her motives.
What's her? There's a boy that she lives next door to. Gosh, he's not called Davy. He's, and his mum is quite...
Howie. They pound bricks, don't they? That's their game. And and he's got a little sister who's always being pushed around, and you know, Ramona's got no time for
it. I'm sure I remember a line where Howie's mother is heard to remark on how hip her son's eyelashes are wasted on a boy.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that you, and it's to get that. I think when you're a child, you understand so much more than you're given credit for understanding. And I think for Beverly clearly to include that observation in a children's book is one of those things that you're not quite sure where the adult's going with that, but you know it's a bit mean.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think she captures that so well, this kind of half the twilight situation where you're a child, you hear stuff. I mean, actually, she deals with some really great stuff with, you know, the dad being out of work and tightening the belt and, you know, family disappointments, not just...
And it's at there's the end, and it's been a really, really awful time, and they all go to a fast food restaurant and have hamburgers, and there's just this sense that everything's going to be okay at last.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, a lovelier and much more powerful ending than snatching a princess from a mountain.
It's so real. It's so real. The pleasure's in small things, you know, the pleasure in a hair slide or a new pair of shoes, or, you know, real things that you related to. So, yeah, big fan.
I am going to pick up High Fidelity because I think this is a really interesting. But this looks like it's possibly a first edition. This is amazing. I'm going to be very careful
this
with
is
it.
This is
a hardback.
Yes.
And it looks.
Yes.
And it just says by the same author, Fever Pitch. There's no great long list.
Yes.
Third impression.
Third.
Okay. August 95. So, I mean, I don't know. Perhaps it's a different time, but to do a third hardback printing. But
yes.
Good for you, Nick Hornby.
Hey.
I'm not jealous at all. This is a book I really love, but I think some treated differently and possibly with more respect because it's a boysy book about boysy things. When did you first read it? And
I read it. Well, I mean, whenever it says
In 1995.
Yeah, I mean, whenever, you know, presumably that's not long after.
Well, listening to Oasis and Blur and drinking Mike's Hard Lemonade.
Exactly. And I have to say, for me, what I remember about it is I laughed. And for me, if a book makes me laugh, not just, you know, you can have different reactions to funny books. You can smile or you can sort of mentally nod and think, oh, that's very true, you know. Or you can actually laugh because it takes you off guard. The joke is just so funny. And that's what this book did to me. And I love an author who can make me laugh. It's just, thank you.
I mean, that is why I'm here.
Well, you know, that is very kind. And for me, laughing is just, you know, it's not what everybody wants from a book. But if I can just lose myself in that, and I find it quite rare. So this book is just, and it's so honest.
Are there any vividly funny bits that you remember when you think of it?
For me, often it's just the lines. It just made me laugh. And when he hides at the funeral, he just thinks, okay, what can I do right now? I'll just hide down here in some damp mud. I mean, I just laughed.
That kind of is what Ramona would do.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
exactly.
I think, you know, a lot of the books I love the most, and I think this is why, you know, so many of your heroines, and, you know, Becky being the obvious one, have been very plucky in a way that's almost childlike and it's instinctive rather than, but also being that everybody thinks I'm an adult and I'm here in an adult's body, but I'm really not. I'm going to have to do this instead.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a feeling I very much relate to. That sort of, I mean, her life that I depicted in the first of the Shopaholic books was exactly my life. You know, I kind of landed in this job as a financial journalist. And I remember on my first day, knowing nothing about anything, I was sent off to a sort of press launch of some financial product. And I sat next to somebody quite senior from Scottish Widows, knowing nothing about anything. And the weird situation you find yourself in is that you are the journalist, and I'm doing really quite big quote marks here, because I was very much a journalist, you know. So they've got to sort of treat you with respect and be nice to you because you're going to write about their company. While they clearly know that you know nothing. And he was asking me questions and I was just bluffing frantically and flushing and occasionally scribbling something down. I was like a child pretending to be a journalist. That's what it felt like.
Something I adore about Becky, I won't talk about her too much because I'm sure you talk about her a lot, but you know, think the freebies, and when she goes to a conference and that she takes two glasses of champagne from a tray, like one for now, one for the boring bits later, and it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and the sort of like going through the biscuits, think I'll get the foil wrapped ones, they'll be good. I've just seen The Code of the Worcesters, which I'd love to. This is a gorgeous edition.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's really beautiful. There's a very sort of ornate cover. I just like trying to paint a picture for the podcast.
So, well, it really is a picture.
I don't know what this is. It's Folio Society edition. So it's got gorgeous sort of gold like foil lettering. And then I'm assuming we've got Bertie on the front with a...
It'll be the cow creamer.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I was like, is it a pig?
What
no, that,
it?
That can't
Piggy
be
bank?
A tiny empress of... When did P.G. Whitehouse come into your life?
I'll tell you something really funny, which is that people used to say to me, oh, you write like P.G. Woodhouse, which
I have always thought that, and I've said that to lots of people.
So incredibly flattering. But the honest truth is that I hadn't really read P.G. Woodhouse when I started writing. I was aware of P.G. Woodhouse. I think I'd flicked through. I think for me to read P.G. Woodhouse, I need to be in the right mood. And when I'm in the right mood, you see, I have subsequently become passionate about P.G. Woodhouse, having sort of thought, right, okay, let's just see what this is all about. And started reading. And actually, I think I prefer the bland, or not prefer, but, you know, I have a great love of the Blandings series. And having sort of really embraced these books, I became utterly addicted. They're sort of books that I have physical copies of, and I have them all on my Kindle in case I find myself, you know, needing some P.G. Woodhouse immediately.
When you're travelling and stuck and it's like, oh, shall I look at Twitter for half an hour and be furious, or shall I have this nice thing?
Yeah, and also they're sort of Moorish, you know. I would finish one and be like, right, well, I need another one now, quick, where is it? And it's just supreme joy. It's just heaven. But it's just absolute genius.
I wanted to ask you what you think about romance and love in books and romantic comedies, because I think in your books, they are ostensibly romantic comedies, as a reader, I often feel as though that's sort of, it's all going to be fine and it's all going to be taken care of. But the bit I'm really excited to read about and the part I love are the friendships and the family. Are you a reader of romance, or do you think that, are you more interested in that as a device for playing out all the other relationships that someone has?
I think what it is that, I mean, I love romantic stories. I love the sizzle, you know, and I love the grand reconciliation. I love all these things, but I can't quite separate that out from where somebody is, you know, in their whole life, because that for me is the sort of reality. So I'm always taking a heroine and putting her in her family context. And actually, the more I write, the more this sort of seems realistic and it's part of who they are. But I love a sweeping romance as much as the next person. And there are these couples that sort of stay with you, you know, and that just are magical to read about. But for me, I mean, to be honest, you know, Becky Bloomwood's first love was, you know, the Denny and George scarf. Luke was very much second. So, I mean, in terms of what I do, I try to write stories about girls having adventures or journeys or doing what they do. And sometimes it's about a man, and quite often it's not, but there happens to be a man who might be there or facilitate, or, you know, but I'm not sort of starting always with that as the primary story.
I mean, because I think of your books, my favourite romance, I've loved them all, but the one I was possibly the most invested in, where I was really shipping them, was in The Undomesticated Goddess. And I thought Nathan was a really good kind of hunky hero, but I guess that was because he represented so much, and it wasn't just, he wasn't a love interest, he represented the new life and the change.
Exactly. And that really is about a girl just working out where to go at this crossroads of her life, and about big choices. And also about, you know, a lovely hunky guy and some raspberries. So
I mean, that the gardening seduction, that's I'm going to fan myself. I've got a bit hot, and that's a really good point for me to pick up this copy of Julie Cooper's Rivals.
Ooh.
So this again looks like a first edition or an early edition. I love these so much because you've got the map of Russia.
I know.
On the
utter joy. Again, joy from first turning over the cover through to the end.
Were you a teenage reader?
I certainly was. I can remember the first, well, I read all the, you know, the sort of the Imogen Harriet books, loved those. And then I can remember walking into the bookshop at an airport and seeing Riders. And
where are you going? Can you remember?
I must have been on a family holiday. And do you remember that cover? You know,
the bum.
Britches, the bum. It was like a no-brainer. I'm clearly going to buy this instantly, and I'm going to inhale it.
Did you have any sort of anxiety about how your parents would feel about you sitting on the plane, reading your book that's covered in a bum?
I'm not sure they would have had any idea what was within those covers. I think they probably just would have thought, oh, you know.
Books, she likes books.
It's a book, that's fine. Yes, no, they should have been more worried about lace, actually.
Was that before or after Gilly? Was Gilly the gateway drug?
When did they come out?
I think
lace might predate. Have you seen how big it is? It's mammoth, it's well researched, it sweeps you from here to there and into extraordinary sex scenes.
But I think that, because there are lots of super sexy books, but the reason I think lace endures and Gilly endures is once you've got to the bits where the pages naturally fall open, there are these really, really powerful friendships between women, and those are the kind of the relationships that stay with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that these Gilly Cooper, you know, the Rutcher, they're a world. I mean, that's the thing. She's creating not just a few relationships, but she's creating a world that you dive into and you're interested in everything, you know, the small characters who come in, just the way of being, the kind of the mores, you know, sort of fast living, lots of partying, all the despairs. It just sort of sweeps you along, and the sex and the love is all kind of part of that, but it's a much bigger creation.
It feels very organic and it pulls you along. And I love that you get to feel conflicted about everything. There are moments absolutely when you're really pleased, moments when you're quite horrified, but also it's very lively and very lifelike.
Oh, I mean, there's supreme plotting again. Mm. I mean, rivals, you know, there's a supremely exciting plot about, you know, rival TV franchises. It's not just sort of people falling out with each other. It's kind of big business. And whether it's TV franchises or whether it's, you know, show jumping or whatever it is, she explains it so that you feel, oh, wow, yes. Mm. And then you start having an opinion on how they should run their business or how they should approach that jump because you feel so well-educated by the book.
And again, I promise I don't do this with all my guests, but the thing I love so much about your books is that they're
You're
all...
You're so nice. You can come here every day.
Honestly, I've not memorized them, but I've read many more than once. You know, the business aspect. Can you keep a secret? And I remember being really struck by how she's sort of ambitious and struggling and hopeful and trying so hard, and no one seemed to be giving her the break she wanted. And then when that finally starts to happen for her, you know, that's as satisfying as any of the other.
Oh, you know, you've made my day, actually, because that's another thing I always try and put into my books is the reality, which is we go to work. Mm. This is what we do. And actually, we do that with quite a lot of our life. So, you know, some of my books really do have a lot in the workplace, you know, in the office or wherever it might be.
And also, you know, girls that are working in shops and things, you know, Fixie, running the family business, really think there's a real thought behind. I feel as though if you did want to launch a shopping business and you'd know the basics about kind of visual display and management and how to look after staff from, you know, reading your book, I think you've got more in there than most people.
I think
I
should have a small disclaimer, you know. Don't try this at home.
I mean, I'm going to say that's an opinion. That's not. I'm not in any sort of retail consortium. I'm going to pick up a book that I have not read and it's been on my shelf reproaching me for some time, and that book is The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Well, I have to say, I loved it. I have quite a funny story about The Goldfinch, actually, which is that I read it and I was utterly gripped. You know, it's just a very sweeping story. It's dramatic. It has sort of some extraordinary settings. And I was so gripped by it that I decided, and I was going through a phase of, my family should all read more. They should all read more. Why is no one reading? So I bought three copies, extra copies, and I gave one to my husband and one each to my two eldest sons. And I thought that, you know, it's got sort of content in it, which I thought, well, you know, how could you not be excited by this, you know, sort of a missing painting and like an explosion. And, you know, it sort of starts with a bang. There's a lot of fun stuff. And my experiment did not work. Son, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying this anyway. Too bad. I'm going to out him. He came down like literally the next day. I mean, we're looking at quite a fat book here. It's pretty weighty. And he goes, oh yeah, I've read it. And I went, okay, you have not read this book. Well, you know, I've kind of more or less read it. I said, what do you mean you've more or less? Well, you know, I've skimmed it. Well, I mean, I know what happens. So that was him.
You read the last chapter.
I still to this day, I have no idea how he read this book overnight. And then my other son started and he sort of read, and I'm showing you now this sort of first sort of chunk. It's 2.5 pages, quite dense, but nevertheless. So he read this, and it's called one, you know, in sort of little Roman numerals. So it's not chapter, it's kind of section one. He read to there and he went, yeah, well, I read the first chapter. And I said, sweetheart, that's not the first chapter. That's just a very small.
You've read three
beginning section. Well, you know, I mean, that was quite a lot. I mean, that was, you know, I mean, it took me quite a lot of time. Anyway, and then my husband, having sort of, I must say, mocked me with my little kind of let me impose reading on my family, I got him to read it, and then got supremely annoyed because every night he'd go, oh God, this is really good, isn't it? And then he'd read a bit, and we'd go, yeah, this is really good, isn't it? Yeah, I'm really enjoying this bit. So I was like, yes, you see? So that was my...
So he proved you right, or you proved
him
right.
He did. And, I mean, you know, some people are put off buy a massive great book. But I just think, well, you know, how amazing is this? I'm going to lose myself in it.
Have you always read? Have there been any periods in your life where you kind of moved away from reading all the time and then came back to books? Or are they something that you've always...
I think the ironic thing is that I now go through times when I read not at all because I'm writing. Mm. And that was never a thing. I mean, I was on those, you know, bookworms, read all the time, reread the cereal packet, you know, that child. Read all the way through university. And I think I probably used to read more even while I was writing. But then, I don't know, I think that I started to pick up the voice of whatever I was reading, and it started to become a bit of an issue. So I find that when I'm writing, I tend to reread because that's not going to sort of impinge on my brain in the same way. So I might go back to P.G. Woodhouse or Agatha Christie. Mm. You're not going to sort of pick up a distinctive voice from that. It's just like sort of sheer pleasure again.
I think Agatha Christie is a really interesting one to reread because, I mean, do you remember whodunit?
No, never. No, I'm very fortunate in that I usually remember it as between sort of one of three. I mean, to be fair, there are some that you remember because they're so distinctive. But there are quite a few, I find, where I think, wait, is it you because of your, you know, simmering jealousy of your siblings? Or is it you? It was one of you. And actually, I've got just enough uncertainty that I can just read it all through again.
I mean, that probably heightens the suspense.
Yes, well, actually, I remember once rereading one and being utterly sure I knew who had done it. And I keep thinking, wait, how's this working out? This is all going... And of course, I was wrong. So actually, that was quite a fun way to read it.
Because I often feel terrible about how little I can remember about a plot of something. Or if I'm, oh, I love this, it's brilliant. And then some will say, oh, great, what happens? So there's a man and I think he's got a hat and someone dies.
I'm absolutely the same. I'm exactly the same. I remember the emotion that I felt when I read it. And I remember that sort of it was, you know, made me laugh or cry. But, you know, the actual details I can get quite hazy on, which is a bonus because it means you can read it all over again.
I'm going to reach over because this book has been catching my eye for some time. It looks beautiful. And I hope it's right to say that your husband mentioned this and pointed it out and said it's the best book about Venice. It's Venice for Pleasure.
Including
Venice for children's pleasure. Oh, and the delights of the Brenta. I read that out the corner of my eye and I thought it was the delights of bees. That makes much more sense.
Recommended this by my lovely former editor, Linda Evans, who has been my editor for many, many years and has recently retired. But she is a massive lover of Venice and I love Venice and had been several times. And then she was the one who said, well, you know, have you taken Venice for Pleasure? And I said, no, I've never even heard of it. She said, oh, you've got to buy it. And what's so lovely about it is that it's just the most chatty... Oh, look, like this, look. View from the Molo. Did I say that right? That doesn't sound regular Italian, but anyway.
I think you probably know much better than I do.
Perhaps the first thing to do, as is generally the first thing to do in Venice, is sit down and have some coffee. Since we cannot take it at Napoleon's coffee house at the old air terminal, we shall have to drink expensively at a table facing the lagoon. I mean, it's like this. But then it's also incredibly knowledgeable about the art and, you know, where you should go. It has walks that take you sort of in a particular route. Now that we have looked at something of the centre of the city, let us explore the city itself. We shall be surprised to find how quickly we have disengaged ourselves from our fellow tourists. I mean, it's just so... charming.
Oh, like a very, very charming, slightly bossy friend. Because I do think as well, any travelling, sometimes you are so overwhelmed and there's always that fear that you'll end up in some sort of, you know, because you're so determined to go off-piste that you don't really know what to do with yourself.
Yes,
so I mean, to have someone say, now this is what we
do. It's terribly out of date. I mean, it says here, over 40 years and 150,000 copies later. So, you know, this is not sort of last year's up-to-date guide. It's just so charming.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
We'll be back to you, Sophie, soon. But now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book I loved so much that paying the cover price alone feels like a criminal act. This week, it's Leila Slimani's Adele, a novel about a woman exploring her own sexual compulsion. Adele has an enviable life. She's a successful journalist living in the centre of Paris with her doctor husband and young son. She appears to have everything, but she has an insatiable desire for nihilistic, destructive sex with unsuitable partners. This is not a sexy book. This is a compelling, consuming novel about the way women contend with our desires in a world where we are made to feel ashamed of wanting too much of anything. Slimani's prose is so spare and elegant that it throws the messiness of the story into stark relief. It's about fear, intimacy, what we choose to hide and what we choose to perform. I think it's one of the very best books I've read this year. That's Adele by Leila Slimani, published by Faber and Faber, out now. Now back to Sophie.
I'm going to get up and pick up another book because I keep bringing the conversation back to shopping and chat, which I love, which I really, really love. But I know you're very, very widely read and there are lots of books here that don't fall into that category, but I've kind of accidentally maybe picked up one that is a little bit. So this is a book that I think comes up a lot on the podcast as something people talk about really loving, but people often don't have a copy of. But you have here a really beautiful edition of The Diary of a Nobody by Georgian Whedon Grossmith. And this, again, I think is interesting in that it's a book that's really, really endured, and it's by a couple of blokes, and the subject matter is trivial, and that's why I adore it. But it's one of those books where you wonder whether it would have endured in the same way if it was sort of sold as women's commercial fiction at the time.
Interesting. I mean, you've got The Diary of a Nobody, and you also have The Diary of a Provincial Lady.
I'm glad
here.
You picked that up, because I thought it'd be interesting to talk about them together.
Yeah,
and for the listeners, I'm going to paint a picture with my words. You've got a really, really gorgeous Virago Modern Classic edition of Diary of a Provincial Lady. It's, I'm assuming, her at a desk with very sort of fashionable of the time bobbed hair.
Well, I mean, it sort of sums it up, doesn't it, really? You know, and this is sort of one bit of her life, and then here's her diary here, which is, you know, what she really thinks.
Mm.
Yes, I mean, interesting. I mean, I think this is, for me, I'm now pointing at The Diary of a Nobody. Its joy is just in the voice. It's what I was saying earlier about, you know, books speak to me that have a voice, and the sort of attempts at dignity, the sort of small umbrages taken all the time, the misunderstandings, again, on such a tiny little level, but that we all relate to. It's a very endearing book. It's very, very funny. And it's one of those books that you can just open, get your little fix, and then, you know, close up. And I love that as well. I mean, I love a narrative flow. I love a plot. I love a... But I also love just sort of some words, just tap into someone else's brain, tap into someone's life, and then come out again.
I am going to pick up a book that I don't know, and I'm curious about. Standard Deviation by Catherine Heine. I think people do keep telling me about this book, and...
It's really good. No, you should read it. It's really, it's charming and it's funny. It's narrated by the husband in a marriage, and it's, I mean, it just starts off with this sort of portrayal of this wife who knows everybody, and sort of he's kind of bewildered by her approach to life. She sort of welcomes stray people into the family, and just seeing her through his eyes is just a wonderful device. And then there's a whole thing about origami, and like you're saying, you know, you can learn about a subject. I now feel I know about origami. There's wonderful sort of portrayal of an origami club. I mean, what happens is that their son gets into origami, so they have to start going along and taking origami quite seriously. And I think any parent also will relate to the thing of your child becomes passionate about something, therefore you find yourself, I mean, with me for a while, it was, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh cards. And I would find myself go, gosh, you know, Blue Dragon, White Strike, that's amazing. Wow, what can I say? And slightly busking and slightly kind of what? And then, but seeing the passion in your child, you know, you want to follow that. And it's just a very tender, funny, clever book. You know, I really recommend it.
Well, I am sold. It sounds fabulous. And I love the idea as well of, I guess, learning about something, because I suppose Jilly Cooper, there aren't many people in that world who are like, what's a horse? But there you've got, you're learning with people who are learning. And I can see how that would be very powerful.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm also going to pick up another two that keep catching my eye, because they're very different books. And I think different from the books we've talked about so far. Here we have Northern Lights. That was the first book in the series. And lots of these books seem to be, one way or another, very much about real life, I guess. But this is sort of, it does tend to be filed under kind of fantasy or, you know, it's in that area. When did you first read it?
I think it wasn't initially. It was one of those books that the buzz grew. And the honest truth is that I just kept hearing about this book, Northern Lights, you know, and that I can't. I think possibly even the whole trilogy had been written by the time I got to it. But I was quite deliberate. I kept my ears closed as to what it was actually about. And I have a bit of a bugbear about blurbs and description on books. I have this sort of slightly deluded idea that if I can just go into a book without knowing anything about it, I will enjoy it in this sort of pure way that the author intended. And I can't stand blurbs that give away kind of half the plot, because then the joy of that plot twist for me is lost. So I actually opened this book without really knowing anything of what it was about, and absolutely loved every page, read the next one, loved that, and then actually saved up the last one to read on a plane journey when I knew I would be undisturbed. And for me, there's just the richness of the world. It's set in a world that is similar to our world, but different in some ways. There's a breadth to it. I mean, there's this whole sort of northern lights, northern bears, and the sort of, that it's all evoked in this incredibly magical way that reminded me of when you were a child and you looked at clouds in the sky, and they almost looked like a land that you could sort of journey into. It sort of wakes up all those wondering parts of your brain, exposes hypocrisy. It's quite thoughtful. There are some real villains. There is some really bad stuff goes on, and then it's heartbreaking at the end.
Because I think it's an interesting example as well of a book that I think is sort of very much marketed to children and teenagers. It was that sort of the older YA end of the market, and then is loved universally. Have your children read it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, it's been a sort of very much a family book. So I just think I just sort of I love to read a book that I marvel at. And actually, I love reading a book that's nothing like anything that I do. So I don't have that sort of professional bit of my brain going, you know, which can't help but think, oh, you know, interesting. Oh, yeah, good choice. Oh, I wonder what I would have done. You know, I can't help analysing books as I read them. And the closer they are to what I do, the more likely I am to sort of that bit of my brain kicks in.
And I suppose it's so hard to read for the pleasure of the story when you're analysing it.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't intend to. It's just, you know, you can't help it. This book, I just felt like a child and just was sort of childlike in my enjoyment of it. So very, very keen.
Are there any books that your children have read first that you've fallen for because
yes, in they fact, met them? So this book here, I was tidying up my son's room and I picked up this book. It's black, quite forbidding looking.
So it's called Gone.
It's Gone. So
by Michael Grant.
Michael Grant. It has a neon sort of black, neon black title. It's very stark and actually I love the way that the pages are neon yellow. So it's very striking book. So obviously I pick it up and I sort of idly thought, you know, oh, and I literally stood there in this bedroom reading. I couldn't put it down. And it's about a world in which all the adults disappear. They just go. And what happens after that? The children have to cope with no adults. I can't remember the age cutoff. It might be 15. And suddenly all the adults are gone. And it's about the sort of the society of children that therefore has to sort of spring up and they have to look after each other and the battles. And then some sort of weird sci-fi stuff comes in as well. But it was just so gripping. I really admire a page that grips you. And this absolutely did. And I read, I would say, maybe two of the sequels. And then I'm afraid I didn't follow. I think there are quite a few and my son read to the end and I'm not sure I did, but you know, kudos to a book that stops you mid tidying up session
when you're not expecting it as well. And I suppose that perhaps comes back to what you were saying about not wanting a blurb, just go in and suddenly be
absolutely
idea. Take on me and the hand beckoning you.
I mean, I know, and some people are the opposite. I've had this discussion actually with friends, and some have said, well, I'm the opposite. I like to know everything about it really before I begin. I read the blurb and I read all the reviews and I really get a sense of it, and then I know if I'm going to want to read it. So, you know, we're all different.
That's really interesting. And I think perhaps now we're definitely in a time when there's just so much to read and to watch. It's a really exciting time for culture, but I can understand why people might feel as though my time is finite. I need to be sure before I... Do you always read to the end? Do you ever stop mid-book?
Do you know, I do stop mid-book, but often because I'm not giving up on it. I'm just slightly distracted by another book, or I have to read another book, or I leave it, you know, at my friend's house and I'll pick it up another time. So that sort of thing. I don't often... intentionally give up. I'm always like, I will come back to that. And I have done, actually. Sometimes, you know, you're just not in the mood for that flavour that day.
Do you know, that's exactly what I do. And I don't think people are either like, no, you must read to the end, which I respect. People are like, no, life is too short, which I also respect. But yeah, I don't think I think there's only ever been one book where I just thought, I am not going to finish this, and I'm not going to say what it is, because I think that's me. Yeah, I only want to talk about the books I like.
Yes, yes. I mean, sometimes, you know, if a book is very hard going and sad, you just might not be able to cope with it all in one go. And you might just think, you know what, that's a really good story, but now I'm just going to read a bit of Map and Lucia.
Yes. Oh, I love Map and Lucia.
Love Map and Lucia. They are another addictive series.
And again, it's that sense, isn't there, of people really being in quite a warm and affectionate way. It's a very human thing, isn't it, I think. Vanity and pomposity and fear of ridicule, and the more you fear it, the more ridiculous you are.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's fantastic human nature. And again, it's such a sort of well-drawn society with its rules. Mm. And what I love about books like that is that you sort of, you inhabit the rules. So you start to learn them and you think, oh, no, you didn't want to do that. That's going to put that person out. Or I mean,
Just like learning about origami.
Yes, like origami. Or actually, I always find that with Jane Austen, that you start to inhabit these rules and you think, should you have said that? Was that, you know, was that a little forward, or should you have approached, you know, you start to sort of see the world through that lens of you know, what's ladylike, that'll have lost you that suitor worth 20,000 a year.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it, that you're sort of, but you're allowed to know everybody's annual household income.
That's it's a bit like the sort of the old fashioned, you know, it's an online profile, isn't it? It's the old fashioned version. 20,000 a year, that's all you need to know.
That's funny, I think, with Jane Austen, the idea that I think Jane Austen and Julie Cooper and you and the Brontes are similar in that there's a real celebration of pluckiness and courage and bravery. But in all those different universes, courage is, I don't think, limited, but it's got to sort of flow around different obstructions and channels. You can be courageous in different ways depending on the laws of that universe.
Yes, it's a kind of pragmatic courage. It's a courage which sort of recognizes the world and thinks, okay, how am I going to navigate this world that I find myself in, you know, to the best of my abilities, but sort of understanding that you know, you're going to have to obey the rules. I mean, Elizabeth Bennet is courageous, and she does sort of, you know, contravene the rules in the sense that she turns down a perfectly good proposal that might have done her jolly well. But she doesn't say, to hell with all of you and your conventions and I'm going off. You know, she inhabits the world. She just subverts it to the limit that she's comfortable with without renouncing everything.
Then Lydia is, in a way, another rebel, and she's fine, but less so. It does look a bit sticky for a while.
See, I'm not sure I would say she's courageous. I think she's just
quite
impulsive and just kind of scratching an itch and not really thinking it through. Whereas I think everything Lizzie does is difficult. But
that's actually a really good point that I'd not thought of, is Lizzie is all integrity, and it's all about that. What Jane Didion says on self-respect, sorry, that's a very pretentious reference, but sort of like having a private peace in oneself. And Lydia, and I think it's youth, but she just seems to be someone who's looking for fun and excitement and distraction, and she doesn't matter if everything's only really temporary in her world. And Lizzie's courage is much more a sort of permanent courage.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And it's I don't know, it is, as you say, it comes out of integrity and knowing the kind of person that she wants to be. And I think Lydia is just thinking the thing that she wants to have. Right,
yes.
Now.
Ah, that is perfectly put. I'd never thought of it that way before.
Well, I don't suppose I had either. It's, you know, this is why it's so nice to talk about books, isn't it? Because otherwise it's all in your head and you sort of have your own thoughts. But, and if you, you know, you don't get to...
I really love the idea that all books are self-help books, and the best books are sort of not judgmental, but there is just that, well, this is what will happen if you do this, depending on, as I say, the rules of that particular universe.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, we're all flawed. We all have our vanities and foibles, and I think the best books are the ones that are benign and understand and sort of compassionate to their characters for their flaws, whilst pointing out the consequences, but finding a way forward. For me, that's what a good book does. I can't really cope with a very kind of a book that is sort of nihilistic, no hope, who knows where this will end. You know, I can't. For me, I like a bit of not saccharine resolution, but at least a feeling that there is a path. It's one of those things that it's nice to see a character that you relate to, and of course these flaws are funny, but it, you know, not everybody has these flaws, and so I think you just have to write characters that have all kinds of flaws, and they can't all be a klutz. Sometimes they, I mean, well, that's why I wrote
you know, a workaholic. Mm. I mean, she's a klutz, but really her flaw is that she works too hard. And I think that's a very interesting flaw. And, you know, perfectionism is an interesting flaw. And I think there's just so many ways that people can be sort of not what they should be.
Something I really struggle with is that, because, I, you know, I believe absolutely that it's not sort of fair or reasonable to think, well, you know, women absolutely have to be likable. A book I read that I really, really loved is friend of the podcast and former guest, Sarah Manning, wrote a modern retelling of Vanity Fair, The Rise and Fall of Becky Sharp, which
is great
fun. Really, really.
I have to admit, that. I have that, and I have not yet got to it for the reasons discussed that I was writing. And you know, I just say, but I'm really looking forward to it.
But she did say that a note she kept getting was, can you make Becky a bit more likable? Well, no, it's Becky Sharp. This is the point. And I think, and there are books I've read where I've loved to have, there's been a central female character who's not been kind at her core, and I think that's really interesting and it can be done brilliantly. But deep down, the books that I will hold in my heart forever have adorable women in, and they're the women I care about. And I know it's, I worry that that's reductive, but I want to love characters.
No, I mean, I think that makes sense. And you have to do what is going to nourish you. I mean, what are books for? They are to nourish our souls. And you're going to spend a lot of time in these worlds. I think the worlds should be good for you.
Yes.
They should be a good place to be. It doesn't mean they have to be all sweetness and light. And you know, you might be nourished by lots of shots of adrenaline, in which case you're going to want a different kind of book. But that's because that's what you need. Mm.
And as you say, there are absolutely different books and different moods. And, you know, it's the flavour you want to...
I mean, I can imagine well being nourished by the frisson of, what terrible things are happening in this book? That's not me. I could absolutely imagine it. But I'm like you. I want to sort of cosy up.
Do you always know where your books are going to end? Do you have the charts and all the notes on the study and the...
I do, but I'm also aware that it might change along the way because, you know, you don't know everything at the beginning. Mm. You learn things and sort of create things as you go along and ideas come to you. I could never do the thing of just sit down and go, oh, you know, where should I go today? I have to have a kind of roadmap, but I'm kind of, I revise and edit as I go.
Which of your characters do you think has surprised you the most over the course of writing them?
Ooh. Gosh, that's a good one. I think actually Fixie, who I've just written, ended up being sort of even stronger than I intended. You know, I think her, I'd always, so, you know, to sort of give the background to her, she's a girl who really doesn't have a voice at the beginning of the book. She can hardly get her words out. This is mostly in respect to her family. Mm. And like you were saying, the family relationships are something I'm, you know, really interested in. And I think I always wanted her to, you know, find her voice, assert herself, become the woman she was meant to be. But I think she kind of went even further in terms of a sort of power shift in the book. And I just found it more and more satisfying to have somebody who is so sort of downtrodden become so strong.
I've had this in my lap that I picked up because it looks really cool. I've got How to Be a Boss. Am I saying that right? A Guide to... Well, it's a surviving, it's crossed out, and then conquering life by Lily Singh. On the subject of being the boss in a literal sense and in a metaphorical sense.
This is a book. I mean, I've been in touch with Lily Singh, who I think is amazing. Very, very funny.
It's a really very description.
Honest. Very good advice.
Can I read what she's written in it? Because I think this is fabulous. Sophie, it's an honour to give you my debut book. Thank you for being an inspiration and making me laugh. Fun fact, I used to get into trouble for ignoring the teacher and reading your books during class.
I have to say so that much. Did make my day. And I felt incredibly honoured that this sort of bright, funny woman should have chosen my book to read under her desk in class. So, you know, it's been a lovely thing to sort of to be in contact with her. And I started looking through this book and I just found so many good bits of advice. I mean, here's one I've just found at random. Don't give away all your secrets or reveal all your vulnerabilities. It's up to you to decide what to reveal and when. Which I think is brilliant advice. And too many people are sort of encouraged in the absolute opposite direction constantly, all day long, you know, share. I mean, actually, funnily enough, this is
putting me in mind of this book here, The Circle.
I love that book.
Where, you know, they start saying, what is it? You know, privacy is theft. Unless you share every moment of your day, you're, you know, withholding it. Why aren't you sharing? Share, you know, and sharing can be good, but it can make you vulnerable. So I think this is really good advice for, especially for maybe younger girls who don't know when they are allowed to say, no, I'm not going to tell you that. You know, well, what did you do on your date with, what's it, what did you get up to? You don't have to spill. You can just protect yourself. I got really into this subject when I wrote my YA book, Finding Audrey, which was had sort of bullying and mobile phones and all of these sort of toxic issues in it. And I just sort of realised that people weren't understanding that they don't have to reveal everything about themselves, whether it's pictures that you send people or whether it's bits of information you give out. Anyway.
One book I really wanted to ask you about was A Vicarage Family by Nell Stratfield, which is, it's kind of an autobiography, but not, isn't it? It's almost autofiction,
yes.
I guess,
yes.
Or early autofiction. And I loved all her books, but I remember being really, really moved and really compelled by the amount of kind of sadness. And she writes these really families you fall in love with, where there's a lot of love, and this family, her own family, is different. Did you read this after reading sort of Ballet Shoes? And
yes, I mean, I'd read all of them, you know, Ballet Shoes, White Boots. I mean, I loved those books as a child, and I still do. And, you know, I think so many of the authors that we've talked about today, they create their own distinctive world. And what I love about her world is that there's always sort of super talented people, usually several of them, in the same family. And they take it incredibly serious. There's always sort of some boy who takes his piano playing just so seriously. And it's all treated with a level of professionalism. It's not really fun. It's more like a vocation. You have this talent and you have to do something with it. And then there's usually the one who doesn't shine and is, you know, a bit grumpy and a bit put upon And reading this book, you see this sort of very sad character, which is presumably Noel Stretfield. I mean, it's all, as you say, it's sort of written as fiction, constantly struggling. I mean, obviously not always sad, but you just feel the sort of, well, what we were talking about earlier, the sort of the siblings, the pressure and the way that you're defined by your siblings. It just sort of shines through.
Yes, don't want to assume too much, perhaps the real life version of that there is something about you that's really, really special, but you will never know it because you're around these people who just won't see it for whatever reason.
Yeah, she's just a character who just rubs people up the wrong way in her immediate family, and has this very saintly father who's the vicar, and then the mother's trying to sort of run a vicarage, which I think is no, you know, small matter. And what's so interesting is you read it and you have glimmers of all these other characters in the other books.
And
the ending
just opened up this bit quite, and I remember it so vividly about it's Lent and someone's given them breakfast and they put hundreds and thousands on bread and butter.
Yes, well, they're told they can't eat anything except bread and butter. And then I think they've gone to a party. And so it's bad enough that all they're allowed to eat is bread and butter.
Oh, that's it, because it's the plainest thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it is bread and butter, but it's got hundreds
and
thousands
of
it.
And then this moral dilemma that they have. Do they eat it? What do they do? And they all look at the eldest. And it's this massive, massive deal. And then there's a lovely bit, actually, in this party, I think, where poor Vicky starts to pretend that they had better dresses that they could have worn. And she's very realistic about, you know, if you are not as well kitted out as that other family. I mean, Ballet Shoes is full of this, kind of cobbling together the dress for the audition.
The attaché cases.
Yes, and you know, pawning the necklaces and all this sort of thing. And it's very it's very matter-of-fact and sort of quite hard-nosed about you need...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Money, you need the and this, you know, we could have worn our blue silks. She starts sort of...
And that really performative, as I think sometimes you do sort of see children doing it, a way of taking control of the situation. And when, you know, no one's probably sort of thinking or noticing.
Exactly, exactly. And sort of goes too far. And you can see in this scene where she will be the writer because she's kind of already sort of creating a sort of alternate reality in which they have all these amazing dresses at home. They just didn't choose to wear them. They could have worn them, but, you know, just not today.
Huge thanks to Sophie. Do read I Owe You One, which is a burst of pure, life-affirming joy that will power you through the end of winter. And then tell her how much you loved it at Kinsella Sophie on Twitter and at Sophie Kinsella Writer on Instagram. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me on my journey and validating my nosiness. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyB. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. That's the letter ybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time for more novel behaviour.